Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 15,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A new Florida abortion restriction is picking up momentum in the state Senate.
We're sentencing children to have children against their will.
Also tonight, another Senate hearing for Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration Secretary Mary Mayhew.
You don't do this work unless you are deeply committed to the populations, to the individuals, to the families.
We'll also check out a legislative move to regulate the potency of medical marijuana, while there's another move on to deregulate the licensing of certain professions in the state of Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to week number 6 of this year's Florida legislative session. This is Capitol Report. A bill requiring minors to receive parental consent before having an abortion cleared its first Senate committee today. Sean Mulcahy reports the House version has one more stop before the floor.
The Senate Health Policy Committee narrowly advanced the parental consent measure on a 5-4 party line vote. Tempers ran hot as pro-abortion and anti-abortion advocates clashed outside the committee room.
Harold, don't hear it.
Do you want your 30 pieces of silver now? You're a baby killer.
I tell you, this is an egregious offense against God Almighty, and it is an offense against our...
Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell is the bill's sponsor.
This bill protects minor girls who are pregnant or considering an abortion by involving at least one of their parents or legal guardians in the decision-making process. The bill further provides for a judicial waiver process for minors under certain circumstances, such as abuse, or when obtaining their parental consent is not in the best interest of the child.
Florida currently has a parental notification requirement for minors seeking an abortion. This measure expands that provision to include parental approval. Only one parent or legal guardian needs to consent, and minors can get a court waiver in limited circumstances. That's if the judge finds the minor is, quote, sufficiently mature or in certain dangerous situations like abuse. But Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book says the current judicial waiver system for parental notification isn't even working like it should.
I started calling through several clerk of courts just to see, did they know, because this is a current process that exists right now, and at least 5 or 6 had no idea what I was talking about when I called.
Amanda Bennett is a case manager for Jane's Due Process in Texas. She says there are cases where a child's guardian isn't their legal guardian.
Hundreds of the young women I work with went to the clinic with grandparents or aunts who they had lived with for years, but who had never gone through the expensive court process to get legal guardianship papers. Despite having loving, supportive families, they had to delay their abortions and experience the anxiety and terror of a judicial waiver.
Opponents also worry about cases where a child's parents are divorced and one parent consents, but the other doesn't. The state Supreme Court ruled a 1984 parental consent measure unconstitutional, in part because the bill didn't have a judicial waiver provision. The court struck down another attempt in 1994. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of abortions in Roe v. Wade, citing the Fourth Amendment's right to privacy, and Florida has an expanded right to privacy under the state constitution. That's along with judicial precedent set by the state's high court, which says restrictions on abortions must advance a compelling state interest, and they must be done in the least intrusive means necessary. That's not the case in this bill, according to the committee's Democrats.
were unnecessarily and unconstitutionally interfering in one of the most personal and life-changing decisions one can ever make without knowing anything of the circumstances that have brought them to this moment in their lives.
That's Boynton Beach Democratic Senator Lori Berman. Democrats have also suggested the Republican-controlled legislature is pushing through the new abortion restrictions to test the state's Supreme Court. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis appointed three new justices earlier this year, drastically shifting the court to the right. Senator Stargell says that's not so.
No, many of the things that the courts addressed was regarding the judicial bypass portion of the bill. We have extensively changed that portion from what was the bill before, so this is a very different process than what was before the courts at that time.
Proponents of the bill argue traditional family dynamics are under attack. They say it's necessary to preserve the rights of parents. Here's Lady Lake Republican Senator Dennis Baxley.
I cannot imagine a situation where my children would have no say in what happens with their minor children. That's just a basic construct. I can't. The school cannot give them an aspirin, but someone can take them as a minor child to make a decision that is an invasive surgical procedure.
Those sentiments were echoed by Stargell.
I think it's a fundamental right to have parents involved with the relationship with their child. I think that parental rights is vitally important.
But Senator Book is pushing back.
We're asking a judge to decide if someone is mentally capable of having a child. If that individual is not, then we're sentencing children to have children against their will.
The House version of the bill has one more stop before the floor. I'm Sean Mulcahy.
New Agency for Healthcare Administration Secretary Mary Mayhew got her second positive vote of confirmation from a Senate committee today. Ryan Daly reports Mayhew faced another tough line of questioning, but won over a previously no Democratic vote.
At Mayhew's first confirmation hearing last week, Democratic Senator Daryl Rusan inquired about reports that ACA was pushing cuts to reimbursement rates for providers who treat children with autism. The former top Medicaid official for the Trump administration surprised the committee by announcing the agency was no longer going forward with the proposed cuts. Rusan says he's concerned that funding for the program is only protected at this time.
How do we know that you're not going to turn around after this confirmation and then do the rate cuts to those providing services to autistic children?
Mayhew acknowledged to the Senate Health Policy Committee the timing may have seemed suspect to some.
I realize the timing seemed remarkably close to my confirmation hearing, or I obviously came out the day of my confirmation hearing. We had just had the first public information meeting about the rates, about other changes that we were proposing.
Mayhew didn't guarantee that cuts are completely off the table and said meetings will be held through the rest of the year on the issue.
We are not moving forward, and we are going to use the summer, the fall, to get comprehensive information from providers, to have meetings. We're going to continue with meetings around the state so that we can hear from individuals to get good information about the cost.
Rusan's fellow Democratic Senator Janet Cruz had questions about the former Maine head of health care's record.
According to the reports, you proposed to cut your department's budget in Maine, which we've freed up to pay for income tax cuts for the wealthiest 2% in your state. How does this maintain your claim that you protect Maine's truly needy?
Mayhew defended what she characterized as a necessary financial move that she insists ultimately benefited programs.
Our focus was to get the financial house in order, and when we did that, we dramatically increased our funding for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities to reduce our wait lists. We eliminated the wait list for homemaker services, which is the meal preparation, support with house cleaning.
Karen Woodall with the Florida Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy is urging senators not to confirm Mayhew.
Senators, I just want to remind you, Florida's Medicaid population is three times larger than the entire population of Maine. Than the entire population, not Medicaid, the population.
Senator Daryl Rusan, who was a no vote at Mayhew's first confirmation last week, now says he's willing to take a chance on the new secretary. Rusan adds he met with Mayhew for an hour and a half after last week's meeting.
And in this instance, I looked her in the eye and I said, the cost is human capital if you do not do right by the vulnerable. The cost is loss of life, loss of access to beneficial services, needy services. by the neediest of our population. And so I'm willing to give a chance based on sworn testimony about her, not a newspaper article, not a speech on YouTube, but twice now sworn testimony.
Cruz, meanwhile, says the ACA secretary post isn't something on which she's willing to gamble.
Many have said, I think I just heard that they want to give you a chance and see how you handle this new role. Well, ACA's budget is almost $29 billion. Florida's Medicaid program has 4 million enrollees, and this is not something that you take a chance on.
Mayhew ultimately passed her second of three confirmation hearings with a 7-2 vote. The only two no votes came from Democratic senators, with Lauren Book and Daryl Rousson voting for Mayhew's confirmation. I'm Ryan Daly.
A political committee has started moving forward with a petition drive aimed at overhauling Florida's primary election system. The committee, All Voters Vote Incorporated, paid $125,000 in March to BHAP Petitioning Partners LLC for petition work aimed at getting two proposed constitutional amendments on the November 2020 ballot. That, according to a new finance report posted on the State Division of Elections website. Still to come on Capitol Report, military veterans could soon not be charged for a medical marijuana ID card in a bill that would also cap the potency of THC for the drug at 10%.
This PCB, it's bad policy. It's bad policy to tie the fee waiver for veterans, their medical marijuana ID cards, to limits to THC, which no one has asked for.
Are many of those Central Americans seeking U.S. asylum actually climate change refugees?
This is a reality. If there is not agriculture in Guatemala, how can they survive?
And lawmakers are looking into a plan to deregulate a number of professions in Florida.
We actually get phone calls from Floridians who have been arrested for the crime of hair braiding without a license.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Last month, Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill into law that allowed medical marijuana flower to be sold in Florida. Now, a sponsor of that bill is trying to cap the potency levels of medical marijuana sold at treatment centers, and at the same time waive license fees for veterans. Opponents say it's a double-edged sword, and Blaise Ganey has the details.
This bill would limit the amount of THC the MMTC may dispense for dried leaves and flowers of marijuana to 10% THC.
That's Fort Myers Republican Representative Ray Rodriguez, sponsor of the medical marijuana bill that allowed marijuana flower to be sold to patients. That bill satisfied critics of the state's ban on smokable marijuana. Now, an effort to cap the potency of the product is riling up advocates again. Kissimmee Democratic Representative John Cortez says he's being inundated with emails.
Right now, they're stating that 10% is not enough, that the dispensaries are giving 16 to 20%. They want to know why we went to the 10%.
Rodriguez points to research.
We believe that there's science that shows greater than 10% THC has been linked to harmful effects. So that's why we have chosen the 10% limit. There's also science out there that has shown that less than 10% is effective for medical purposes. And so we have used that as the delineation. We're just following the science.
But military veterans who often use the medication as a substitute for opioids say limiting the potency would lead to negative results, and that they oppose the bill even if it benefits them a little. Melissa Villar of the Holistic Cannabis Community thinks the same.
This PCB, it's bad policy. It's bad policy to tie the fee waiver for veterans, their medical marijuana ID cards, to limits to THC, which no one has asked for.
West Park Democratic Representative Chevron Jones says allowing veterans to waive the $75 card fee is great, but he believes the legislature is adding overbearing laws that doesn't allow doctors freedom.
We cannot tie the hands of the doctors. If those the doctors who are prescribing, if we're saying, okay, all you can give is 10%, but yet and still they believe that, you know what, this individual might need a little more. Now the doctor's like, well, listen, I don't want to go to jail, so I'm not going to give you any more.
Meanwhile, Ron Watson with AltMed Florida says the proposal could result in people smoking more, which some believe is the opposite of what the legislature wants.
And strangely enough, if you're trying to discourage people from smoking, by passing this bill, you'll actually be encouraging them to smoke more, because if they are approved for this route, it will take more for them to get the same results, and the price will go up.
Representative Cortez believes the best thing to do is to get all of the professionals in so they can be advised on what the best thing to do would be. As of now, he says the 10% cap ruins the bill.
If we would do it the right way, and act like I did the last time with the smokable bill, where we get all information, communicate, get the professionals, and tell us how do we do this the correct way. That's what we need to do. I love Rodriguez's bill, but the cap is the killer.
The bill passed its first committee last week and is up in the House Appropriations Committee Tuesday. There is currently no Senate companion. I'm Blaze Ganey.
The Sadowski Housing Coalition wants the state of Florida to spend money contained in the Affordable Housing Trust Fund on affordable housing. But as Gabrielle Bolden reports, while the Senate is going along with that concept, the House has different ideas.
CEO of the Florida Housing Coalition, Jamie Ross, says the Florida legislature has been sweeping the trust fund for years.
For more than a decade now, where the Florida legislature has been sweeping the Sadowski State and Local Housing Trust Fund into general revenue, because the problem has become so severe that most local governments do not have wait lists. The reason is they don't want to get people's hopes up when they're no longer able to serve them because the money isn't coming from the legislature.
Florida has the third highest homeless population in the nation. Cities such as Orlando, Miami, and Tampa have become some of the worst places for affordable housing. Much of that inventory was wiped out in the panhandle during Hurricane Michael. The House wants to use a third of the trust fund money to restore it, which is upsetting to affordable housing organizations.
The hurricane just exacerbates, an issue that exists. The housing trust funds are not there for the purpose of hurricane recovery. The housing trust funds are there to deal with the statewide affordable housing crisis.
Mark Hendrickson helps lead the state's Housing Finance Association. There's an estimated $352 million in the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. The House also wants to allocate $200 million toward other areas of the budget, once again resulting in a trust fund sweep. Meanwhile, the Senate wants to put most of the money to housing programs, and Senate Appropriations Chairman Rob Bradley is holding firm.
We have our position. The House has their position right now. There's a lot. There are differences between the Senate and the House on that and several other issues. And I think it's a mistake for anyone to take anything off the table. But our position's strong, and that's how we feel about it.
His House counterpart, Panama City Republican Representative Jay Trumbull, says there's always going to be an issue on what the money will be spent on when it comes to affordable housing. His North Florida district was directly in the path of the storm.
But I think it is incumbent upon us to ensure that in situations such as these, in Hurricane Michael, where communities are literally brought to their knees, every single apartment complex in Bay County, as an example, on the east side of the bridge was unlivable for 5 months. And, you know, I mean, so there is a huge need of folks to be able to get into a place quickly and affordably.
The Senate and the House must agree on a plan in order to allocate the housing trust fund money. I'm Gabrielle Bolden.
State and national lawmakers may be dragging their feet when it comes to addressing climate change, but that's not stopping the consequences of it, and that includes immigration. Many Central Americans crossing the U.S.-Mexican border are Guatemalan climate change refugees. WLRN's Tim Padgett reports from South Florida.
And if they don't stop them, we're closing the border.
Last week, President Trump threatened to close the southern border because record numbers of Central American families are showing up there. But there is something unusual about this wave of Central American migrants. Most are not from Honduras or El Salvador. Most are instead from Guatemala. And immigrant advocates say, based on their conversations with those Guatemalans, that what's driving most of them now is climate change.
Hay que darle duro, lo agarras así, puah, puah, puah.
Abraham is an indigenous farmer. That pow-pow he's describing is the sound of his hoe hitting dry earth back in Guatemala. After years of drought and erosion, the soil in the western Quiché highlands he comes from is hard as rock, and it no longer produces the crops his family needs to live.
Maíz, frijol, pero antes sí le da mucho, pero ahorita ya no.
Corn, beans. When I was younger, we often had full harvests, says Abraham. Now, nothing. So in December, facing starvation, Abraham took his wife and two young boys on a two-week-long trek to the U.S. border. There they asked for asylum. After U.S. immigration officials processed them, they headed for Lake Worth, Florida, to join the large indigenous Guatemalan community here. Now they share a two-bedroom apartment with five other Guatemalan migrant families.
Antes sí había río, había todo.
A river used to run by my village, but it's gone, says Abraham. He asked us not to use his last name since his asylum case is pending. He adjusts the bracelet monitor U.S. officials put on his ankle and says, our pretty country is no longer there. At least not his corner of Guatemala, part of El Corredor Seco, the dry corridor. Scientists say climate change has been hostile to agriculture in that region. Last year, farmers there say they lost 90% of their crops.
The number of Guatemalan families, new arrivals, are increasing. And I see the level of desperation, extreme poverty.
Amanda Escalante is a family aid coordinator at the nonprofit Guatemalan Maya Center in Lake Worth. She says the Guatemalans she's helping now are part of the world's new and growing cohort of displaced people, climate change refugees.
This is a reality. If there is not agriculture in Guatemala, how can they survive?
But how has climate change made Guatemala's Corredor Seco so unsurvivable?
Volatility is really what affects farming systems.
Dan McQuillan is a Guatemala expert and agriculture programs manager for the nonprofit Catholic Relief Services. He spoke to me from Calgary, Canada. He says that climate change volatility is so damaging because it brings things like erratic bursts of hard rain even during drought, and that can kill crops for years to come.
The soil is baked hard as concrete, and the rain comes pouring down, battering the crop, and then just runs off. We're seeing a tremendous amount of erosion and loss of the productive topsoil.
McQuillan thinks Trump's plan to cut off aid to Guatemala and other Central American countries will backfire and force more people to migrate. There is concern Central American governments don't use U.S. dollars effectively. Guatemala's environment minister, Alfonso Alonso, told WLRN he has a climate change relief program, yet he says he has no environmental experience. Guatemalan migrants say they saw little help in their country. Like Guillermina, who is 20. She asked us not to use her last name because her own asylum case is pending. She's an indigenous Guatemalan woman who arrived in Lake Worth just a few weeks ago from Huehuetenango, part of the Corredor Seco. Shortly before Guillermina left for the U.S. border, her mother died of an illness made worse by malnutrition. Her mother also left a one-year-old baby boy. In her Maya dialect, Guillermina says she couldn't leave her baby brother Ronaldo behind.
I carried Ronaldo in my shawl the entire way. He got a fever and I was afraid he'd die, but I got him to the border and into a hospital.
Because Guillermina is not Ronaldo's mother, U.S. immigration officials couldn't let her bring him to Lake Worth. For now, he's in a crib in El Paso, Texas, one of the youngest climate change refugees in U.S. custody. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, under a bill moving through the Florida legislature, a list of professions, including interior designers, hair braiders, and boxing announcers would be allowed to work in the state without a license. The measure also reorganizes the Florida Building Commission. But as Regan McCarthy reports, opponents say the bill isn't as simple as it sounds.
At the Institute for Justice, we actually get phone calls from Floridians who have been arrested for the crime of hair braiding without a license.
Christian Cameron works for the Institute for Justice. His organization largely supports a measure by Bartow Republican Senator Ben Albritton. Albritton says his goal is to make it easier for people to support their families. In addition to deregulating hair braiders and interior designers, the bill would make it easier for certain professionals that still need a license to get licensed in Florida if they've already been working in another state.
Many of those folks that came over from Puerto Rico after Maria, if they were licensed over there, and the reciprocity and endorsement process, which I think it's important to bring up, includes Puerto Rico, our territories, other states, that would certainly give them the flexibility to participate in this economy and get their financial life back in order.
And Albritton says the measure would let them freelance because under his bill, appointments would not have to be booked through a salon.
It allows hair shampooing, cutting, and arranging to be performed by a licensed professional outside of a licensed salon, even when not in connection with a special event. So the goal there is to help folks that may not want to be a large-scale. They have the training, they have the certification, and they may not want to be part of a large-scale salon.
But Ms. Verol, president of the Florida Association of Cosmetology and Technical Schools, says there's more to many of these professions than some might think when it comes to applying makeup, for example.
Certain dyes have chemicals that cause a reaction in many individuals. Red dyes are a prime example. Sanitation, without proper sanitation, the general public is at risk of contracting any number of diseases: meningitis, staph infections, acne, allergies, contact dermatitis, scabies, ringworm.
And Verol says cosmetology makeup also includes microblading and permanent makeup. Others are concerned about a portion of the bill that changes the composition of the Florida Building Commission. It would reduce the number of people on the board from 27 to 19. Sarah Boren works with the U.S. Green Building Council.
Specifically, the seats for a member of a municipality that implements the code on the ground, an education sector representative where we shelter in our public schools for during hurricanes, an expert in fire protection engineering, a member of the building owner and managers association, and a county code enforcement officer are key to long-term resiliency.
Despite concerns the measure is moving forward, it has one committee stop left in the Senate, and a similar bill in the House is heading for a floor discussion. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Gabrielle Bolden and Tim Padgett from WLRN. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 15,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education. Online at myuff.org.